Today's episode is brought to you by Blue Apron. For less than $10 a meal, Blue Apron delivers seasonal recipes along with pre-portioned ingredients to make delicious home-cooked meals. Some meals available in September include spicy hoisin chicken stir-fry with baby bok choy and sesame ginger cucumber salad, or summer udon noodle salad with cherry tomatoes. Check out this week's menu and get your first three meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/untitled. That's blueapron.com/untitled. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. And now on with the show.
Welcome to Still Untitled, the Adam Savage Project. I'm Will.
I'm Simone.
I'm Tom.
Hey, Tom. So Tom Sachs is our, I guess you're our substitute Adam this week. Is that fair?
I've got my, I'm wearing my fedora.
Okay, very good. So Tom, if you don't know Tom, Tom is a sculptor. He has made amazing art. And you kind of, I shall let you describe, because I always feel like a jerk describing other people's work.
My name is Tom Sachs. I'm a sculptor. That's my priority, is always sculpture, but I investigate other cultures and amplify them to make them my own. So I have my own space program. And in 2007, we landed on the moon at Gagosian Gallery in Beverly Hills. Our two astronauts landed on the moon, jackhammered up the Richard Meyer floor, brought a sample back and tested it, and found it. We did a petrographic analysis and found that, in fact, our moon rocks were made of concrete. In 2012, we went to Mars at the Park Avenue Armory, and we found life.
I think you need to. I think
now I'm leaving out some details.
I think we need to take a step back. Yeah, because it's kind of what you do is it's kind of cargo cultish, right?
Sure, a cargo cult is sort of a anthropological term used to describe a culture that's adapted and morphed by another one. The most famous is the John Frum cult, or maybe there's a movie called The Gods Must Be Crazy, where the local or the Aboriginal people find a Coke bottle that falls from the sky and worship it because it can be used as a rolling pin, and it screws up their entire economy. It comes from a text about the Yamamamo Indians who called iron axes for Stone Age Indians, where anthropologists introduced iron axes into a Stone Age society and totally fucked up.
They did this on purpose?
Well, it was kind of on purpose or by accident. They traded an axe for beads, and then the economy, the local economy, got all screwed up. And this has happened over and over again. This is one of the terrible side effects of the Anthropocene, mm-hmm. the time when humans have the biggest impact on the planet, or the Homogenocene, when humans have the biggest impact on other cultures. Then that's the time, sort of from the 15th century till now.
Is there no anthropologist prime directive? Like, they don't have a rule that says, hey, don't come here and jack up these other cultures?
There absolutely is, but as a result of learning the hard way through situations like that. And wow. We, you know, we shove the prime directive up its own ass in our space program. There's this thing called the Planetary Protection Protocol, which is mainly set up to avoid false positives. We don't want to go to Mars and find a bacteria that we brought there. But it's also used ethically to not bring Earth bacteria to grow and take over Mars. But we kind of say, fuck all that. We're Americans. We're colonialists. We're going to represent who we are, and we're going to bring the noise.
You spray painted a flag, an American flag, onto the floor.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, in a way, our main science package is a boombox. You know, we bring the noise of American culture, and that's the African diaspora, because we are built on African blood, and we do not do projects of any kind without acknowledging that, because it's the Africans who helped us get to the moon, who brought cotton and tobacco from the earth and brought to Europe and gained economic independence and worked in the factories and helped us to defeat the Nazis and steal their best scientists and ultimately go to the moon and kill God.
This is so far away from my usual line of thoughts. Like, I have a lot of people who ask me, like, do you consider yourself an artist? And I'm always no, because you're obviously an artist. I mean, you're like the embodiment of an artist.
No, you're an artist.
I'm not. I'm not cool enough to be an artist, no, I feel.
You're an artist because your robots are self-proclaimed shit. What do you call those? Shit robots? Shitty robots.
Shitty robots. Not, I Google translated a headline on a Spanish article and it said, Simon Yetch builds robot of shit. I thought it was, they're not made of shit. They're shitty robots. So. But I mean, because you have this like whole thought process around it and this very like good way to talk about what you do, this beautiful way of talking about what you do. Do you feel that that's like telling the story of what you do is a big part of your artistry, or is it mainly the art itself?
Well, make no mistake, my priority is making sculpture, and I will use whatever I have to get that job done. There's that line, you got to use what you got to get what you want. It's about shaking it. And the thing that saved my life. I had a very troubled youth, and I discovered sculpture in my early 20s, and I had an instant success. I mean, it was a dozen years before I ever had an exhibition or my work left my studio, but I had an instant sense of self success.
Like you knew this was what you're supposed to be doing.
I developed my own internal standards of excellence through sculpture instead of external ones. And so I will do whatever it takes. Now, all this storytelling about it is very important because it's a way of communicating the ideas behind the sculpture. And these are things that I'm thinking about as a person, as a sentient being, as someone who's witnessed the incredible racism in our country. I'm not going to use what I do. I'm not going to do what I do and not acknowledge the source. I'm not going to do what I do and not use it as an opportunity to talk about the larger problems that are bigger than the ones that I have. You know, I'm not African. I'm like an upper middle class Jew from Connecticut who went to college. But the art that inspires me, people ask, who are your favorite artists? And they're all the artists of the diaspora. You know, it's always James Brown and Louis Armstrong in that tradition.
So when you were a kid, I have to assume that the space program that now, like you were the right age to be there. I mean, how old were you when Neil Armstrong walked on the moon? Do you remember that?
Well, you know, the thing about memory is you don't remember what you remember.
Well, you remember watching the TV replay of the memory of the
right,
thing.
Right, and it all kind of mushes together. So I was 3
okay,
when it happened, but I don't really remember. But I watched Star Trek, and I've seen...
Just as good, yeah.
And I've seen every episode.
Of the original series, I assume. Well, or all of them.
No, the original and Next Generation, but... Mainly the original. I think I could be quizzed on pretty thorough. And I got to go to a shuttle launch, and I got to watch both disasters. And as a kid, I was definitely the right age to have had the vision that we all did that going to space would be an everyday thing.
Right, we'd all be living in toroid habitats.
Well, I guess I would say that, you know, I'm not a native to the digital world, that I'm an immigrant because I was born earlier. However, I was a native to the idea that of prosperity in space, and I think the locals in the digital world grew up in a sort of cynical place with like the shuttle, which is like totally idiotic
and boondoggle.
A tautological cycle, right? It didn't really flying toilet.
Would you go to space if you had the opportunity to?
I don't think I have the right stuff.
As in the right equipment?
No, I think I'm too nervous. I don't think I'm equipped to do it.
Mentally?
Yeah. And also, I've done a lot of astronaut training, and I still kind of keep up with it. Like things like... I stopped with the underwater pressure stuff, but I still do alpine mountaineering, and that's pretty much the exact same thing in terms of like preparation, training, and technical risk, all that stuff. It's about as dangerous. I don't think I love it. And to quote Adam Stelzner, the most dangerous place on Earth is 10 times safer than the most friendly place on Mars. Mm. And the Earth is like a big, warm, wet kiss. And I want to explore Earth before going.
Okay.
The big, wet, warm kiss of Earth.
Yeah.
That's the artistry in it. I would never describe it as that. It's like, oh, it's stuff.
Oh, no. I've watched you fix your septic system on YouTube. There's some good artistry in there.
Yeah. I mean, look, anybody who's done some amateur plumbing can watch that video. Not that I'm suggesting you're an amateur plumber.
No one can.
I'm saying, as an amateur plumber myself, you know, the joy of finally getting that, making that right turn and getting it where you need it to be, it's amazing.
But I would say
it's not art.
The expression of nausea, I've never heard so perfectly articulated. I think I have to rewind. I rewound and watch you gag on the smell, because you know, in movies and photography, it's impossible to represent smell. Like, you ever see any movie and you can tell that it's a bad smelling scene? You never get a sense of it. But that movie,
yeah, did it. You knew that you didn't want to be in that room.
Yeah, yeah.
So okay, so you're here in San Francisco now because you're doing the space program, a space program.
Yep.
In San Francisco.
So September 16th at Yerba Buena Center for the Arts on Mission and Third, we'll be launching Space Program 3, Europa. Our two astronauts will be landing on the surface of Europa. They'll be drilling through its icy crust to its liquid ocean. They will be abducting a subject, grilling it, and eating it.
A subject as in?
We don't really know what lies beneath the ocean, beneath the frozen crust of Europa.
Well, I mean, Arthur Clarke said, don't go there, right?
Right. Use these in peace.
Yes.
All these belong to you. Use them in peace, but this one doesn't. And we say, fuck that. We're going.
Okay.
Maybe an unfortunate museum visitor will be there and you'll grill it and eat it.
Possibly.
Oh,
better turn off your cell phones.
So how are you feeling about the exhibit? Are you excited about it? Are you nervous about it?
I'm really excited. We have the best installation crew. Tessa Freeman, the director of installation, has been kicking ass for months. Dorothy Davila, the curator, has been leading an amazing team of people. We've got dozens of people working over at YBCA right now. We've got mission control section being set up on Wednesday. We have a historical section of earlier SAC's works with a timeline. We even have Logjam Cafe, where you can come buy a cup of coffee that we collaborated with. We've got Lofted Coffee from Bushwick, Brooklyn, because we're bringing up, we're representing East Coast.
Mm.
And
no gang signs, please, Tom.
And
troubled youth.
Still love Tupac, but you know, Biggie is in my heart. And Byron Kaplan's Cafe Peddler is our collaborator with that. So you can go to Logjam Cafe and sort screws. We've got an algorithm of sorting random screws, so you can, in a way, indoctrinate yourself in the culture of the studio. And I hope that you guys will come.
Oh, that's
and
awesome!
Sort screws with us.
So this is something you talked about this on the Talking Room with Adam, I guess a couple of years ago now, maybe 3 years ago.
Been working on it for a couple.
Well, but the sorting screws, you talked about something that you bring people. So you have a fairly large studio in New York where you have, what, 15 or 20 people working at any time?
13.
Or 13. Okay. And you said that you bring people into the studio, and this might not have even made the final cut. We might have taken it out. I can't remember. But you said you bring people into the studio, you take their ADD medicine, and then you give them incredibly tedious tasks to help them learn how to focus and find inner peace with like the kind of repetitive work that most of us don't do anymore.
Right. There's this quality of the work we call tedium, where we do these unbelievably tedious tasks, but at a pretty high level. It's like it's almost like making the Torah. Like, you cannot make a mistake, so we build it in sections. So you throw the whole section out if it doesn't work. But that section might take a week. But it doesn't take a year, so you only lose a week's worth of work, not a year's worth of work. And a week's worth of work is a lot.
Yeah.
Even at minimum wage, which we don't pay.
You don't want to lose a week's worth of work ever.
Right. So we have these ways of testing and vetting. Now, we don't take people's Adderall away. However, I was given a jar of Adderall, adolescent adolescent grade pharmaceutical amphetamines by an employee, an intern who said that she didn't need it anymore because she found her ability to focus on her life through the work.
Oh, that's awesome.
And her mom called me and I was really happy because I love Adderall. It's like the modern cocaine. It's a superior party drug. But I only use it for fun. I don't really.
It's not for focus enhancement purposes.
It does work. I just don't need it.
Are you going to be on Adderall on the date of your exhibition or exhibit?
Well, there's a marathon demo that's very long. It's, I think in New York it was 11 hours. We're trying to figure out a way to make it 5. And in the middle of that, there is this thing called the indoctrination ritual where we all gather around and we mix Adderall with Kool-Aid and we recite the Mentat prayer.
You have people drink the Kool-Aid?
Yeah.
Hold on, which one's the Mentat prayer?
It's
Herbert, right?
It's actually David Lynch wrote it. It's not actually in the book, but they, you know, they stuck it in. It's by Will Alone. I Set My Mind in Motion. It's by the juice of Safu that lips acquire stains, that thoughts acquire speed. It is by Will Alone. I Set My Mind in Motion.
So you're saying Adderall is our closest equivalent to Safu?
It is. Okay. And that's that movie, not the book, is about drug culture, and he's making comparison between drugs that we're addicted to, like heroin and cocaine, when there was a lot of cocaine on that set, if you read the stories, and the mind-altering substance of the spice melange that helps people see visions and gain strength, and also the worms mind melange on Arrakis, and then the Navigating Guilds take the melange to navigate to like fold space.
Hyperspace, yeah.
But the important thing is that this movie's a metaphor about our dependency on petroleum, because the locals on Arrakis are these poor people that are miners, and they're being exploited by these Belgians, the Atreides, and there's this war of other European states and developed nations. So it's really a metaphor for how we exploit the resources on Earth and fight over it. And you see that happening in Nigeria with this incredible new wealth that this country has, but it's the government so fucked up from its Belgian roots and French roots that it doesn't have a structure of democracy that's viable. So it's a big mess. There's incredible poverty there. These issues are, not explicit in the work, but they're implied. And these are issues that I'm interested in. So, Simone, when you say that I'm a real artist and that you're not, I really am going to argue with you about that, because you have a rich cultural history of your own life. And I work hard to bring those ideas into the work. But bottom line, it's just about making spaceships. I only want to make cool shit. And I think that's where you and me and Adam, that's where we meet, is that there can be a reason behind it. But bottom line, it's the stuff like Adam's blaster, right, from Blade Runner, right? It's more accurate than the one that's made in the movie. It's heavier. It's not made of rubber. It's made of metal.
I'm just wondering if that is like one of the main differences, because to me, in the projects I do, I shy away from having a reason to do them, because people always ask me, why do you do it? And I'm like, why not? I think the building process is a reason in itself. And if it feels for you, there's a lot of like reason around it and a lot of focus on the reason as well as to why you build these things.
Well, I think there's probably more reasons behind why you build them than you're admitting or that you are even aware of. And I don't think it's necessarily important for you to convey those in the way that I'm conveying them now. I'm interested in conveying them because I think the storytelling opens the door for different ways of understanding the work. These are just my interpretations of my work. You'll come and see it hopefully later today, and maybe you'll have your own views. And I don't think that they're wrong, even if they're divergent. I think if this was the only way that you could look at what I do, it would be propaganda. I'm not interested in that. I want the work to have a little openness. Now, smarter artists than myself say nothing.
I mean, when I, so when I haven't seen anything in, I haven't seen anything you've made in person. I obviously like the stuff, the bags and stuff like that that you've made, which are these unbelievable kind of, they look like artifacts from an alternate space reality, right? The, because you make them out of the what's the spacesuit material?
Ortho fiber.
Right.
Or this one is out of Cuban fiber.
And it appeals to me in the same way that
Vectran, like, also.
Vectran's such a good name. Yeah. That watching like my 3-year-old kid will take a cardboard box and play with it. And the difference is that she's 3 and that you spend a year or two or longer in some cases building these incredibly elaborate displays. Yeah. And making that fantasy even more and more real within the context of what it is you like.
Well, you said cargo cult, and the word I use, I like sympathetic magic, another anthropological term. Sympathetic magic is a voodoo doll that you push pins into, or you build a model of your enemy's fort and burn it down as a way of visualizing the demise of your foe. In the same way, you could, there's this thing called an ex voto, which is you build a model of your arm, maybe you broke your arm, you build a model of it. You bring it to your religious practitioner. He helps you pray to it. And what he's helping you do is visualize creatively the success of your healing. Like, if you hurt yourself and you believe you'll never get better, you'll stay sick for a while. If you believe you're getting better, you'll get better. You can control. The only thing we can control is our thoughts. And through our thoughts, we can affect things up to 20%, which is, in business, they say that's the leverage you need to, like, build or destroy anything. And similarly, I built my space program because I couldn't afford my own. And at the beginning, I did want to fly. But as I was learning about it, it was such a difficult thing that I realized that to organize everything, I really couldn't fly. Mm-hmm. I had to be organizing it. But similarly, this has been my whole life. I grew up in this affluent community, but I didn't have as much – my parents didn't have as much money as the neighbors. So we'd buy things at Goodwill and refinish furniture. My mom taught me about how to do that. And I went to a fancy prep school, and it was really gross. You had to wear the blue jacket and the gray slacks and a striped tie. Or you could wear a suit, but all the kids wore uniforms. So I'd go to Goodwill and I would buy these like 60s mod polyester suits with narrow lapels. And I was the only non-preppy at the school. And I felt in a sense of artistic expression there before I ever made sculpture through clothes.
But did you realize it was artistic expression, or did you just do it to be different? And to, like, what was your
motivation? I did it because I loved punk culture, and like I was introduced to ska and new wave, and it was a way of adapting to the things that inspired me, which is the music. And the clothes were available because it was the 80s, so you could get clothes from the 60s. Mm-hmm. Now if you go to the thrift shops, you get buying clothes from the 90s.
And it's early 2000s.
Yeah, it's awful. And also, those things were better made then, so it was. So I didn't really view it as art or creativity. It was just something that I did that had an honest connection with my life. And I think all we're looking for is authenticity. And I would argue that you are an artist, because if you're making a shitty robot that addresses issues of femininity and like
makeup
lipstick,
application,
hair, hair brushing, you know, shampoo, all these like these rituals that are part of presentation in the feminine body, you are channeling your experience as being a woman in the world, and you're smashing that up against your love of robots and science, and ultimately you're only doing that because you love making shit. I hope I'm not putting words in your mouth.
No, I just see. I think it's interesting with the femininity point, because I think I've only done one project that's like makeup related, or the lipstick robot,
hair brushing.
And the rest. No, hair washing. I haven't done hair brushing.
No, wasn't there like a hair dryer thing?
No, I've done it. I've done it, an alarm clock that slaps me in the face, and a hair washing machine that washes your hair. I think you could use it too.
Hair washing the machine that's like kind of.
So the wake up machine, I was thinking it was a hair brushing machine because of the spectacular failure.
Maybe a hair curler.
Yeah.
Because it like catches my hair.
Tangled.
Got tangled.
Okay.
But none of them are like feminine or have stuff to do with that. I've shied away from it a little bit because I think that a lot of yeah, people want to put it as like, oh, this is like how a woman tackles electronics or robotics. And I just,
I see.
I do more general stuff, but maybe I should do like a hair or like a shaving robot, like shaving robot.
I want the
I can do beard shaving though. My sister forced me to shave my mustache for a photo shoot because she was like,
okay,
Simone, your mustache is so annoying to Photoshop. Please shave it.
So did you shave my mustache?
I didn't. We took a photo of it. It was very, it felt kind of nice. It was like, because yeah. I was doing this thing that I've seen my dad do all the time, and I'm like,
it feels good.
I kind of, yeah, it was like I was playing.
It's fun yeah. until you have to do it twice a day. Yeah.
Mm.
And then you're just like, no, yeah. I'm good.
I stopped.
Yeah.
Yeah, you stopped.
Yeah.
But if you had a shaving robot built by me,
oh yeah,
it would be so much easier.
Yeah, okay.
And,
yes.
and a trip to the emergency room.
Yeah. Are you going to do like straight razor or are you going to safety, you think?
I think you just do an exposed blade.
Okay.
The single edge, the deadly one.
Yeah.
Can we test it on somebody? Is on like a pig or something first? Okay, that's good. Okay, cool.
You
yeah,
can
I'm
be
in.
My pig.
This will be a great
my
video. Everybody will love this. It's what they've been wanting for this whole time.
Fuck feminine robots.
I think that's as good a place as any to wrap it up today. We should explain why Adam's not here, I realize.
And why you're wearing headphones and we're not wearing headphones.
Oh, yeah, okay. I'm wearing headphones because we didn't. Norm and Joey are in the Arctic.
What the fuck?
They're like...
How dare they?
Look, did you know that when they leave the boat, they have to get an escort with some sort of polar bear gun? Well, you know this because you're from the north, but they have to have an escort with a gun in case there's polar bears.
All the polar bears in Stockholm. Yeah, they like take the subway and commute everywhere.
It's like the ones from the old Coke ads, right? They're just sitting there sliding down
hills
drinking
Cokes. But they're all chill. Like, you don't shoot them. You just high-five them.
They're cool because they're Swedish.
No polar bears in Sweden, though.
I mean, Swedish,
definitely.
It's not like they're dirty Norwegians.
American polar bears.
Yeah.
They like fuck up your country.
So they're fighting polar bears in the Arctic
country house
with astronauts. Adam is on a cross country road trip and sent us like 35 photos last night, I think.
And he's in Detroit.
Is he in Detroit now?
Right now, as we speak. But he's on the way. He's on en route.
Making the long... So he showed pictures of... I think he's tweeted a bunch of them, of like Mount Rushmore. I think he went to Devil's Tower.
Yep.
Which...
Oh, we were supposed to speak about that because there's an amazing scene where in
Close Encounters. In
Close Encounters where Richard Dreyfuss is... There are two scenes. He's starting to become obsessed with the Devil's Tower where the UFO lands or whatever it's called, the Close Encounters guy. And he's carving it out of mashed potatoes at the kitchen table, and he gets more and more obsessed, and so obsessed that eventually his family leaves him, and he's takes over the kitchen, and he builds a giant model of Devil's Tower, and he doesn't know why, because somehow the aliens are communicating to his subconscious, and he's obsessed. And he even takes a garbage can, he makes the final tower part of it, and he's like standing back, and he's exhausted, and he's like got the TV on in the corner, and there's a moment. And he's like the classic obsessed artist building this sculpture in 3D, which helps him find the route later versus a woman later in the movie is also making a painting of it because she's a painter. But the 3D model helps him navigate up the mountainside. And there's a moment where he's watching TV, drifting off, staring at this thing, trying to figure out his next sculpture move. In the corner, he sees a news story about the Devil's Tower and that there's all this activity around it. And then he's like, oh, yeah, that's what I'm trying to make. And the moment that he sees that image on TV, he just walks out of the house.
So he's drawing the thing he sees in his head.
He's building it.
He's,
but he's building like a 12-foot high model in his house. And he's destroyed his entire house and his entire family for his art. He doesn't give a shit about anything. He's pure artist's psycho vision of doesn't know why he's building these things, but he's compelled to. And in the moment that he has the answer, which is he sees a stupid news story, he just walks straight out of the house and leaves it behind because he's on a vision, and the vision is to leave Earth and to go be with the extraterrestrials.
I need to watch Close Encounters again.
It's incredible. So that's where Adam is. It's almost like a pilgrimage. And he said it's only 250 feet wide. I think they make it bigger
at the top.
Yeah.
I mean, you should narrow lenses, long lenses or something. So on that note, Adam, we're going to be here next week. The three of us, we're going to talk again. And then I think Adam will be back the week after that, and we'll catch up with all the stuff, like the reading of the Dark Forest, and I think we said we'd talk about Star Trek. I think they talked about Stranger Things a few weeks ago.
Yeah,
we should always talk about Star Trek.
We can talk about Star Trek next time if you want.
If you want.
Okay, well, we'll be back next week with more. See you guys then.
Bye.
Bye.